Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a channel in the New Books Network. I am your host, Adam McNeil, and today we have the opportunity to chat with Dr. Millington W. Bergeson Lockwood, author of Race Over Party, Black Politics and Partisanship in Late 19th Century Boston. And Race Over Party is published by our great friends at UNC Press this year. How are you doing today, Doctor?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Very good, very good. And so before we get into Race Over Party, can you describe for us your journey to this particular book?
Sure. So Race Over Party sort of grew out of two directions. It started with sort of my long interest in antebellum, pre-Civil War communities of color in the North. Thinking about those urban communities and how they imagine themselves in the growing nation. And I was always a little bit dissatisfied with how those stories typically ended. And I mean, the caveat to this is a lot of this has changed since I started the project. But, you know, all these books typically changed with this sort of, the books ended with this triumphant march of African Americans into the Civil War. And that was sort of the last that we ever heard of them again. The black politics in the North in the pre-Civil War period was about anti-slavery, and that once slavery ends, we don't really have a sense of what happens to these communities. And so I was really interested to find out more about the post-Civil War history of these places. And then also, as a student of Reconstruction, I was really looking for Northern African American voices in that history. And, you know, much of that history, rightly so, is centered on the South, and particularly in rural areas. And so coming at it with questions in mind about, okay, well, what happens to these sort of politically vibrant communities like Boston after the Civil War, but also what is their Reconstruction story? How are they experiencing these post-Civil War years? Sort of brought me to Race Over Party. And once I started diving into the sources, particularly looking at a lot of the newspaper coverage of political meetings, you really saw partisanship emerge as a central node in how these black men and women really thought about their place in the body politic and the ways in which political party becomes the battleground over which they're going to talk about citizenship and their rights.
I think one of the cool parts about your book, and really, I think one of the main reasons why when I saw your book on UNC, I think it was on UNC Press's website or on Amazon, I thought, well, I worked for Boston African American National Historic Site. Hey guys, how are we doing? I was thinking one of the parts that we had always talked about that we were fairly light content wise on was what happened after, what happened in that post Bellum period, reaching to where, we talk about the African Meeting House, for example. What happened around the time that, they moved to a present day Roxbury? What happened to the Black community? And so I definitely appreciate you for writing Race Over Party, because what it provides for public historians, I think, in and around the Boston area, is that it does a couple things. Like, it provides people opportunities to know about that past of the late 19th century going into, the 20th, and folks like William Monroe Trotter and others. But also it helps us contextualize even present day debates about monuments. Because, what did we see yesterday, or I guess yesterday evening, what's going on at UNC Chapel Hill? These things are, all in certain ways connected. So I definitely appreciate you for the scholarship on this.
Yeah, thank you.
And so going forward into the book, can you describe some of your primary characters? Because as someone who enjoys studying, the antebellum political culture of Black Bostonians, you have some who make it out of the post 1865 moment, but then you also have those who were well connected to certain figures, shall we say, some through biology as well. So would you be able to talk about some of your primary figures in the text?
I mean, absolutely. So the central character in the book is Edwin Garrison Walker, who, as you alluded to a little bit in your intro, is the son of David Walker, the sort of famous author of, his famous appeal, sort of radical anti-slavery document in the 1830s, 1820s and 1830s. And Edwin Walker really emerges and comes into his own almost immediately at the end of the Civil War. He's one of the first Black men elected to the Massachusetts legislature, and then continues to sort of follow this trajectory throughout the late 19th century until his death in the early years of the 20th. And he remains throughout his career really committed to a politics of race first, where in his view, African-Americans should place sort of racial interests and civil rights above all other interests. And that includes political affiliation. So he's one of the first voices to be really critical of particularly the Republican Party, even from his first years as a legislator all the way until his death. And so he's a central figure in the book, along with others. So I also write about, keeping the theme of biology. I write a lot about James Monroe Trotter, who is William Monroe Trotter's father. Who is also in a sort of ally and compatriot of Edwin Walker. So here I think you see this link, between David Walker and Edwin Walker, this sort of generations from pre-Civil War to post-Civil War, but then from James to William, this sort of reconstruction to 20th century. These connections aren't just ideological, but they really are, they're physical and familial.
And that particular point is very, very well taken, because when I think about, how you constructed your book, I really enjoyed learning about Edwin Garrison Walker, because I felt like people were so taken with David Walker. It's almost as if they forgot that he had a family, right, that outlived him, right? Because Edwin, I believe, was in the womb of his mother as his father died. He is coming of age as the abolitionist movement in Boston, New England, and the greater northern area is really, really, bustling. But as you mentioned, that he becomes into prominence in the post emancipation Boston time frame, which I think bridges the gap pretty well. But also shows, a lot of times when people talked about voting, obviously we're in campaign season right now for many primaries in the nation right now. And so, you know, I think sometimes people take for granted, especially living up here, previously living in the North, is that after the Civil War, typically you think about African-Americans in the South gaining political power, shall we say, and less is thought of what happened to those in the North, those African-Americans in the North. And so I think that's another area where this book is very, very strong.
Yeah, right. I mean, and I think that that raises some interesting questions, right, about how African-Americans in Boston define their citizenship. I think for them, citizenship and voting are part and parcel. Like there's no world for them where they can imagine being citizens and not having the right to vote. Boston has African-Americans in Boston have been able to vote since before the Civil War. Voting is part of their political identity. They never lived in a moment without that right. At least this generation that's in the post-Civil War period. I think voting is a crucial way that they understand their political world. And I think you see that in particular in their opposition to the 14th Amendment. You know, when Edwin Garrison Walker famously gives a speech decrying the 14th Amendment as this sort of unholy compromise, it's around the fear that if voting isn't connected to citizenship in that amendment, that any further action is going to be not as comprehensive in terms of protecting voting rights.
And because Edwin Garrison Walker, the way that his story was told, he sounded largely like a political pragmatist, in the sense that he took opportunities, right? You know, so partisanship for him was not as important as, you know, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong in my interpretation of this. It sounded a lot like Walker wanted what he thought was best for the race, and whether or not that was the Republican Party, whether or not that was, you know, working within the patronage system and working without it. So it seemed like he would do what he thought was best for the race in ways that, you know, at times put him, you know, on the wrong side of particular folks within the Boston political community.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that Walker is, you know, I hate to throw this word around, but he's a radical among his cohort in Boston, where, you know, he's really adamant that unless a political party is going to be fully committed to Black rights and the interests of Black people over all else, then African Americans do not owe them anything. I mean, this is the era where you have folks like Frederick Douglass and others talking about, oh, well, the Republican Party is the ship and everything else is the sea. You know, that like it or not, your best hope is with the Republican Party. And Edwin Walker refuses to follow that line. You know, for him, an ideological commitment to equality and to justice trumps political pragmatism. I think his criticism is that the Republican Party is full of these pragmatists that for the sake of political expediency will compromise on Black rights. And he sees that writing on the wall fairly quickly in the 1860s, and then sadly is sort of proven more and more right as the century continues.
And you're not lying about that, because when I see his you know, debates about, I believe you're talking about before the 14th Amendment, and looking at how African Americans, right? Because when you think about the Republican Party at this time, right, this is right smack dab within, you know, they're among their strongest period within this time frame, where to say that you are not, to say that you to the point where you're an African American political activist and you're saying that you are not going to hold your Republican weight, that was a rather dangerous thing to do, within the political realm for someone who had aspirations within the city. Could you talk about some of those spats that he did have with folks in the community?
I mean, sure. I think you see particularly sort of conflicts between folks like Walker, folks like Trotter, and some of the sort of famous names of Black abolition in Boston. Like, so Lewis Hayden, for example. You know, Lewis Hayden is a staunch Republican after the war and really looks at that party as a as the vanguard of civil rights. And, you know, and in some ways, Hayden's not wrong. You know, that's the political party of Lincoln. It's the party of abolition, the party of positive Reconstruction, that I think folks like Hayden, folks like Douglas, are really, really want to celebrate. But I think that for Walker, he looks at that as a cop-out. He said, you know, he says that, you know, the African Americans have a commitment to hold these parties accountable and not just sort of give them any sort of, you know, allegiance based on these sort of past deeds. It's sort of a sense of like, okay, well, what is the party doing for me today? You know, is this the party that's going to stand up for us in the future? And he feels that increasingly by the 1880s, especially, that that's not the case, that the Republican Party takes Black votes for granted and isn't willing to really risk its political future in order to save Black lives and protect Black rights.
And I mention this because, you know, some of the, like, it sounds so eerily similar to almost what, you know, some say about the modern day Democratic Party, right? It's because a lot of times people, you know, who are Republican today, or maybe politically conservative in general, will say, you know, we're the party of Lincoln. And no, well, that's more hyperbolic. In the time frame that we're talking about is actually true. This is literally the party of Lincoln, right? This is, right, you know, days, years, you know, months, right, after his assassination. So, you know, for you to say that, you are definitely on the fringe, shall we say, especially in a city like Boston.
Right, yes, especially in Boston, right? So for folks to sort of declare political independence, and not just declare that you're going to be politically independent, but then turn around by the 1880s, like Walker does, and support Democrats, it's professional and political suicide. You know, even, you know, by the time Walker dies, he says that, right? That he says that, you know, the graveyard of your hopes and aspirations is political independence, that it would have been much easier for him to just toe the party line, stay with the Republican Party, and reap these rewards. Whereas, so after his election in the 1860s, he really never finds equivalent electoral success. And that's largely because of his inability to sort of play by the rules in terms of Boston politics and following the Republican Party. You know, even to, like, there's this great case where, you know, Edwin Walker is a proud supporter of Benjamin Butler, the Civil War general turned politician. And when Butler becomes governor of Massachusetts in the early 1880s, he attempts to appoint Walker to fill a vacant judge position. And that appointment is defeated by a Republican-dominated executive council in Massachusetts. And then, sure enough, like, Butler tries again with George Ruffin, famous African-American but Republican, and that nomination is approved. And so Ruffin, now we know George, if you know your Boston history, we know George Ruffin well, right, as the first African-American elected or first African-American judge in Massachusetts. Well, that should have been Edwin Walker. So if these questions of partisanship don't get in the way, Walker is the one we now know is the first Massachusetts judge, rather than Ruffin. And so we can see how, you know, partisanship, not only does it affect Walker's sort of material condition in the 1880s, but it affects his legacy and how he's remembered.
Right. And like I said, there were political consequences for his actions, and you know, like you said, at times it was political suicide for him to take the stances that he did, especially with someone as far as how African Americans perceived him as Governor Butler. And then also, I thought the part that I hope that folks don't under remember or not understand is how relatively short the governorships were, or at least it seemed like it. Because typically, I think we're used to 4-year terms for governors, and I guess what is 6 years for senators. But was governor? I might have just read this wrong, and so I apologize if I did. But was the governorship only like 2 years? Because I felt like it was a quick transition to go from Walker to Ruffin.
Yeah. No, I mean it's almost year to year.
Right.
Yeah, the elections. Yeah. No, and so. So politics can shift and move very quickly.
Right. And so, because like I said, Butler was a very, you know, not only like the actual term, you know, Democrat will bring you, booze and such in the, within the Black community at this time, but, you know, he was not a relative friend to, at least the majority of African Americans, you know, this individual case notwithstanding. So, you know, with that as well, I thought, you know, that part was
Yep. Yeah, sorry. No, I mean, I think Butler does have a lot, like, he's sort of a famous character within
he has
the Black
interesting
community.
Story, yeah.
Well, because of his, you know, he's sort of touted as sort of creating the category of contraband during the Civil War that allowed fugitives to be free. And he's one of the sort of radical voices of Reconstruction, and so I think he does, you know, Butler's sort of maligned for better or for worse for corruption and some other things, but in the eyes of a lot of African Americans, like Butler has sort of earned his earned their loyalty through some of the service to Black rights.
Right, and yeah, absolutely can't overshadow the contraband nature, you know, going back to Fort Monroe during the Civil War. Because, yeah, it just seemed that, you know, like you had mentioned before, the fact that, you know, Walker seemed to be very melancholy about that, too, about his opportunity to effectively lost to be, I guess, a Black first. I was not sure if they were cognizant of those kinds of things back then, but he was at least aware of some form of political significance of this too. As well, a part that talking about monuments too, someone like Crispus Attucks, right? You know, is an important figure in Boston history, Black Boston history, especially when you talk about, you know, the nature of masculinity and the nature of manhood in this time frame too, especially when you talk about manhood and citizenship being intertwined and interwoven, especially in a place where military, you know, as I kind of call them, you know, Black military, Black patriotic masculinity ran within all forms, you know, because go back to, you know, Prince Hall and the Prince Hall Masons and going all the way up to this period too, because I was, I think also another area that was very interesting too, when you talk about monuments and commemorative spaces.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that, questions of manhood and masculinity are tied up in a lot of this, the rhetoric of independent politics. So you'll hear folks like Walker, but not just him, a lot of the other voices talking about, you know, that for African American men to really assert their manhood, it means to be politically independent. That, you know, true manhood means voting for the party that's best going to represent African Americans. And that to do otherwise is subservient. That part of expressing your sort of free, powerful masculinity is through independent politics.
Exactly, and because that, you know, independence means, you know, because it's, you know, every now and again you'll see, you know, the, you know, you're kind of like the master slave kind of narrative, even in post emancipation. Right. Politics where, you know, I'm, you know, not, you know, enslaved to, you know, such and such party, or I'm not enslaved to a particular kind of politics. So definitely I'm on that particular point, because when you look at, you know, the importance of the Prince Hall Masons to the city, and you look at the history of You know, the history, you know, you look at the 54th Massachusetts, right? You have, you know, them being a very important piece interwoven into the fabric of Black Boston life too. And then you have the commemoration that comes about too. So would you be able to give us a brief breakdown about how the monument on Beacon Hill becomes comes into fruition too, and the struggle to make that happen?
The Crispus Attucks Monument.
Oh, I'm speaking kind of Crispus Attucks, but also looking at the Shaw Memorial too, because that's also an important piece that I definitely hope people either know and or remember.
Yeah, I mean, the legacy of the 54th and of Black Civil War service, you know, sort of throughout all of this, right? So there are, you know, veterans. A lot of the characters I write about in the book, you know, served in the Civil War. James Monroe Trotter was a lieutenant during the Civil War, and so that military service is really ever present as in part of their argument about why they should be politically independent. So they'll talk a lot about, well, you know, really it was Black soldiers that freed the slaves. It was Black soldiers that brought about this new nation. That they don't owe the nation or the party anything. If anything, the nation and the party owes them. That it was their blood, their deaths that brought about these changes. And so rather than And so they'll really use that military service to make arguments for why the political party should respect them.
And that's why I thought this part was pretty interesting, because of those particular reasons. Because I always, you know, because a lot of the work that I personally have done has been in this particular area. And so I was really, you know, I was very happy to see such a prominent role, you know, the place of commemorations played, but also something that I never actually thought about that I like to ask you about too. Your sixth chapter I thought was very interesting, considering and just to let y'all know, the sixth chapter of Race Over Party is entitled For Ireland's Cause: Black and Irish Political Coalition Building. And if you know anything about Black and Irish American relations, it's been a mixed bag at best. Would you be able to talk to us a bit about, you know, the coalitions and the political nature of, you know, the policies of African American or Black Bostonians and Irish folks in the community at this time?
Sure. I mean, so chapter six was really that was one of the most fun chapters to write.
It definitely seemed that way.
Yeah. Cause as you said, you know, that the history of when we think about African-American and Irish Boston, the word cooperation and coalition and alliance is not usually, it's not typically the words we use. And so it was really exciting to discover this history. I mean, not, you know, I discovered it for the book. But and then write a little bit about you know, what was going on, and it's really, I think it's a powerful moment in the city's history that we need to talk more about. And so for those who haven't read the book, they in the 1880s, African Americans support the cause of Irish independence in Ireland, and they support the candidacy of Hugh O'Brien, the first Irish-born mayor of Boston, and they become sort of powerful figures. In support of Irish independence, and you'll often find Irish nationalists and African Americans sharing the stage at political rallies, and that they do for this moment in the 1880s really do forge some alliances and forge some powerful connections, really bringing together the struggle for Irish freedom along with the struggle for African American freedom in America. And as the chapter progresses, you know, there's, you really see some of these, occasions where, for example, Black Bostonians, host a fundraiser, and they send money to Ireland for Charles Parnell's home rule movement. And so this is African-Americans, Black Bostonians, sort of scraping together their hard-earned resources and then sending those to a foreign independence struggle. And then the chapter, you know, culminates with the construction of the Crispus Attucks Monument, which a lot of people know and they see sort of on the, you know, it's on the Boston Common, sort of right off the main strip there. And you, you know, millions of people pass that monument every day without knowing its history. And that monument really grew out of this this cooperation, you know, that it grew out of a need to celebrate some of the Irishmen who died during the Boston Massacre alongside Crispus Attucks. And so here you have sort of in stone, a sort of permanent monument to this moment. And so that's what I really liked about telling that story is, you know, every time now that I see that monument, that's a monument not just to deaths during the War for American Independence, you know, but it's a monument to Black and Irish Bostonian unity that I think is important to remember. You know, as we talk about race in Boston and how fraught that topic continues to be, I think it's important to have touchstones like that monument to think about ways and times in which the story could have been different.
Exactly, because when you like you mentioned before, you know, the fraught nature of Black and Irish relations, right? There's really only been a couple times where outside of the story where it's been fairly strong, at least in this century, and that was, you know, the history of someone like Robert Morris and his connection to Irish folks in the community. But really, outside of that example, there aren't that many. So it's good to see that there were examples of coalition building and also, you know, so some cooperation and actual, you know, tangible things that were able to be taken out of that. And I thought also an area of the book that I thought I had not really thought about too much, but was so, so profound and important was the anti-lynching activism of Black Bostonians as well. Because as we trek through the 1880s and folks like Ida B. Wells and Frederick Douglass are speaking of the Southern horrors that is Southern lynching and American lynching as a whole, you know, Black Bostonians do play a role significantly in anti-lynching activism. So would you be able to narrate that story a bit for the listeners?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, by the 1890s, you know, Black Bostonians are some of the first Black communities, you know, in the North to sort of actively oppose this and actively support anti-lynching campaigns, that they really start to become very agitated over what they're seeing as the rising tide of Black death at the hands of lynch mobs across the South. And so they host Ida B. Wells, and they become really sort of animated by anti-lynching, and they connect anti-lynching to part of this this narrative of Black independent politics. So they point to lynching as sort of the ultimate betrayal by the Republican Party. That, you know, even while Republican governments continue to dominate the federal the presidency and Congress, this lynching is increasing. And so they often use that as a way to sort of shame the Republican Party. And they become very, very vocal anti-lynching activists by the turn of the 20th century, where they're going to raise money to bring the Baker family to Boston. The Baker family, the father was a postmaster, and the family is sort of attacked and their house burned and their newborn child murdered along with the father in this lynching. And the Black Bostonians will raise money to bring that family to Boston. That's sort of a famous anti-lynching case. But there are others that, you know, they really become outspoken against lynching, even from the very early years in the 1890s.
Right. And you know, I thought it was really interesting to see the notation of someone like Ida B. Wells, who came to Boston, I believe, during this period too, to rally support for her cause. And because I say that, because when I think about the political culture of Black women in this time frame too, you know, you had Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin, I believe was her name, who was, you know, one of, I think she founded the Ida B. Wells Club in Boston too. And she was one of Ida B. Wells's earliest supporters in the North and in Boston, behind, you know, folks like T. Thomas Fortune. But here in Boston, she was one of the most prominent people. So as kind of like that of a segue too, because we're also pushing towards what we, you know, they may not have known at the time, but we now know, pushing towards, you know, the women's right to vote, or at least within the 19th Amendment. But can you speak a bit about Black women's politics during this period too, and their push?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, so Black women are in this book sort of throughout, but feature most prominently in the 1890s, where you get women like Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin, who found this Women's Era club, you know, and she's going to start the Women's Era newspaper. And we're going to be one of the founding members of some of these larger national Black women's organizations. And the thing about, you know, Black women in the vote in Boston is that Black women vote, like that women can vote in Boston for school board elections. And so this, the relationship between women and the ballot isn't a figurative thing in Boston, that they're that they are voters in at least some sort of small extent. And so they're very outspoken about the role of the vote and the place of partisanship. You know, I spent some time writing about Pauline Hopkins, who is you know, best known as a journalist and novelist and playwright. But she knows, I mean, in her sort of famous book Contending Forces, which is often regarded as this sort of romantic novel, she has some very pointed chapters within the book, looking at questions of Black partisanship, and using fiction to document this narrative of Black independent politics. And so, I think you do have, so independent politics is sort of firmly entrenched in some of the women's politics in Boston.
And that's really good to really harp on, because, you know, sometimes people think that you know, women didn't really have, you know, that obviously that they were politically organizing and such like that, but as if, you know, the vote, you know, that there wasn't really much else besides the vote that you could do prior to 1920. But, you know, Black women were, you know, largely organizing themselves, and like you mentioned, that they had the right to vote in particular ways. But, you know, that wasn't the only thing that that they necessarily were worried about, right? That yes, they wanted, right, you know, the outright right to vote, but also that there were ways that while they were, you know, pushing towards that there were things that they were getting engaged in too, and they were not passive observers to what's going on, but they were active agents to change the world for how they wanted. And so I would say definitely the most prominent would have been Miss Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin, who's politically organizing well before this time frame too, because she was doing work even during the latter antebellum era, going into the 1860s and 1870s as well.
Yeah, for sure. No, I mean, and they're always present. You know, I mean, sadly, some of the nature of just the way that women's voices are documented is that you see them a lot, but you don't hear them too often. So, like, the newspapers will often document their presence at a meeting, but we don't necessarily hear their voices. And so I'm really excited for opportunities and for the to when you can actually hear them, not just see them.
And you know, I have a site, you know, Black Women hoodie that's coming in the mail today. You know, that's, you know, that's largely, you know, what we try to do here. You know, we always like to cite Black women and to uplift their voices and amplify them whenever we get the chance to. So a part of the New Books in African American Studies channel, we always like to do that. That's always a yeah, thing absolutely. That we like to do for sure, man. And so going into the final section of our chat today, it's crazy. 39 minutes just go by so quickly when you're, you know, in having a great, great time talking about a great, great book. Would you be able to talk to us a bit about kind of the final area of the book when kind of your timeline begins to wane a bit and we start talking about, you know, education and going into the latter portion of the 19th century, going into the 20th?
Sure. I mean, so at the end of the book, I really sort of write it, and I struggled a little bit with how to frame the end of the book. And it really, to me, is this—it's the culmination of this tragedy, which is the sort of faith in electoral and partisan politics as a vehicle for Black progress. And I think you see, particularly in the final years of Edwin Garrison Walker, you know, where he really I think the sort of the rise of Jim Crow and the rise of lynching. Really hits a lot of these activists very hard, and they take it, you know, rightly so, sort of very, very personally and very like devastating to watch the sort of optimism they had, even if it was sort of a realistic optimism, to watch that door of progress slowly close over the late 19th century, and to look ahead to the future in a world that I sort of argue is outside of formal and electoral politics, to look towards forging their own national organizations like Niagara Movement, like the NAACP, that I think that is a culmination of a lot of this race first thinking. You know, that if progress is going to be achieved for Black men and women in America, it's going to be through Black activism. That it's not going to be as part of a interracial political party. It's going to be with Black leadership and Black voices in the forefront. And so I write about the end of the book sort of as this tragedy with a silver lining. So there this sort of defeat of independent politics or collapse of independent politics as a viable strategy to combat white supremacy, I think yields the growth of these other organizations that are going to become as strong as any political party. And so the book concludes with the rise of William Monroe Trotter as sort of carrying the torch of his father, of Edwin Walker, sort of into the next century.
And that's where you coalesce into things, you know, that you don't necessarily talk about, but, you know, folks, other scholars who reach into the 20th century nature of Boston, because, you know, we know William Monroe Trotter, you know, largely as a friend to Du Bois and Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard and master's degree from Harvard and, you know, fighting against the showing of the Birth of a Nation in Boston and such like that. And so he's carrying the multiple mantles of activism, which largely come from this time frame of Black politics and partisanship that you greatly highlight in this, what I would say is a greatly misunderstood and or just not known period of Black activism of what exactly was the world that Black Bostonians fought for in the antebellum era and in the Civil War. Right. This is the world that they were fighting for. And those who were, you know, some of them like Edwin Garrison Walker, who was living and knew, you know, what life was beforehand. You know, they're fighting to change the world. But many of them, you know, they were upstarts. You know, they were ones who were coming around when, you know, there were what we now know as Black colleges around. Right. And so, you know, they're They're coming into a different world, but that different world was a world that was created largely by those who were within this particular story. And so with that being said, now that, you know, we have, you know, race over party, black politics and partisanship in late 19th century Boston completed, what can we look forward to next, if you don't mind me asking from you? Because, you know, as sometimes here at the New Books of African American Studies channel, we always like to not only know what our scholars are, you know, have done, obviously, with the books that they've completed, but we get a little bit greedy sometimes. We like to know what's coming up on the pike for you guys and gals.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, so the book just came out in May, so I'm taking a little bit of a breather, trying to figure out what's next. But, you know, your listeners may or may not know that I've been living overseas in Malawi for the last couple of years, and that really made me think a lot about the place of you know, African Americans abroad, in Africa in particular, and thinking about the place of black diplomats. So I've got some ideas kicking around about another project looking at the role of black diplomats. So, for example, folks like Frederick Douglass, and others that I write about sort of in the 19th century, a lot of them are going to become some of the first black diplomats abroad. And I'm very interested in sort of charting that history and writing a little bit about what it means to represent, you know, not only African Americans abroad, but then have to simultaneously represent the United States with all of its fraught racist legacies. So, that's what's you know, sort of percolating right now, is really thinking about how issues of race and identity might coalesce abroad in the work of some of these black diplomats.
And that sounds like a tremendous, tremendous foundation to have, because, you know, black politicians and black diplomats are something that I think is, you know, within the transnational frame would be a very, very intriguing study to take up. Especially even within the particular period that your book on Boston highlights as well, because, you know, political patronage was an important thing going all the way up to the Wilson administration in the early 20th century. So I definitely think that that's a phenomenal work that hopefully once it comes into fruition and you get a publishing date for it, that you'll definitely consider coming back on the program. It's definitely been a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be able to share this story. I hope readers will find it interesting and that it's a slightly new take on the Reconstruction era, but also I think would cause people to think a little bit more about the place of race in political parties today. I know that we got an election coming up. All elections are important, but this one's especially important. And you know, I know there's always questions about race and political affiliation. So I'd hope that race over party might give a little bit of historical context to some of these discussions.
And for that and much, much more, we have been just blessed and graced with the presence of Dr. Millington W. Bergeson Lockwood with his new book, freshly published through our friends at UNC Press, entitled Race Over Party: Black Politics and Partisanship in Late 19th Century Boston. And once again, this is your host, Adam McNeil, on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. Until next time, folks, over and out.